Next Chapter Podcasts. Hear Shakespeare like you've never heard before.
But thanks to all at once.
Who by next moon?
Thee we invite to see.
Who will be crowned at Scone?
Play On Podcasts are epic audio adventures reimagining timeless tales with award-winning actors. Listen today at playonpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Boil and bake.
Eye of newt and toe of frog, pull of bat and tongue of dog.
The 500. J.A.M. been walking us down through that 2012 edition, so it ain't nothing to you. Hundreds more to go and in need of a friend. The king of fleas for Angelo, talking the 500 until the end. Talking the 500 until the end. With my man J.A.M. on the 500, talking the 500 until the end.
I dare any of you to put this record on and not call your Coke dealer and go on a 3-day bender. The song is Golden Years. It's by David Bowie from his 76 record, Station to Station. It's also number 324 out of 500 on the 500 with me. With me. What's up? How's everybody? Good week? Dude, it's Bowie week. It's fucking Bowie. It's if you're from Philly. Fucking David Bowie. You guys like fucking David Bowie? You see the movie Dune? Fucking Dune. All right, what are we talking about? What are we talking about? Join the Patreon if you want to. Nobody is. Ladies and gentlemen, I have so much cool shit going on. April 3rd, I will be at the Comedy Store doing the goddamn comedy jam for the 50th anniversary with Bobby Lee and Maj Jobrani and Jeff Ross. And then April 9th, I'll be doing a goddamn comedy jam in Connecticut at the Wall Street Theater that you can stream from your home at wallstreettheater.com. That's April 9th. April 18th, I will be at the Nashville Comedy Festival doing shows and doing the goddamn comedy jam with Big J and Kid Rock. Oh, yeah, did I say Kid Rock? And then April 20th through the 24th, I will be at the Moon Tower Comedy Festival. And then in May, a bunch of cool shit. Netflix Festival. I'll be in Minnesota at the House of Comedy. And then in June, I'll be at the DC Improv. And I'll be doing a jam at 9:30 Club, which is a big deal for me. So, come on. Oh, subscribe to my TikTok. And I'm trying to build a fucking following through clips. I'm posting a lot of clips right now from like crowd work, small short jokes. You guys are supporting him. To everybody that's like liking him and sharing them, thank you guys so much, man. It's just, listen, man, this podcast brings me no money. So we need to get the money on the road up. So either do one of two things: share my social media at Josh Adam Myers or subscribe to the Patreon, which I see nothing. I don't get one bit of the Patreon money. It goes to all the other people that work on the show. I haven't gotten paid from the show in months. And that's why we're promoting on Broken Record, because hopefully those people will come over here and listen to Scoodle. So, back to what's fun. David Bowie. I didn't mean event like that, but, you know, Peter's probably going to cut it out because that's what he does. But, you know, or it's Adam. I don't know who's editing this anymore. If it wasn't for Emily, let's just be honest here, people. If it was not for Emily, and look, I'm not trying to say I don't like doing the show. I love sitting down to record this show. It's just tough to go from making so much money with Spotify, with Dark Lord Spotify, and then making nothing. And then be like, fuck yeah, dude, dive in and research this Jackson Brown record for 10 days. So that's my frustration. I'm still doing it. I'm still going to keep doing it because, you know, I told Angelo I would. And that's literally the only reason that's keeping me here. And then some of you guys. Some of you guys are fucking awesome. Notorious RGA. I love you. Maria Hernandez. Fletch 3. Mike, the dude that wants to wear my skin. Yeah, dude. I love you guys. All right, so this was a biggie. David Bowie, our first one on the podcast. I don't know if any of you experienced what I just went through. Like, I you know, love Bowie. But man, did I just go on a Bowie tear throughout all of his music over the last like 2 weeks while I was digging on this. And you gotta just say, this dude is arguably one of the most original musicians that might have ever lived. So what did we do for guest wise? Because this was an album. It's a shorty. It's not a biggie thickie. It's a shorty quickie. And so who did we get? The lead singer of the band Bush. Gavin Rossdale. That's who we got. Now, I gotta let you guys know. He was in Australia in a hotel room. His internet probably was not good at all. It was very choppy. It did not go as planned, which is a bummer. Not his fault, not our fault. You know, it's just the fact that he was in Australia. We were supposed to do it before he left for Australia, and then shit got fucked up. And so here we are in this situation. And hopefully the editor put this together to make it a great interview, because Gavin is a great dude, man. We were joking around right at the beginning. We started and stopped the podcast like 5 times at the beginning. Mine cut out, his cut out, this cut out, ba 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 da ba ski ba da 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 da. Which is the gold stereo, young Americans, we are the younger, the hotel podcasters, all right. Rate, review, and most importantly, subscribe to the 500 and listen free on all platforms. Follow me at Josh Adam Myers on all social media, and go to joshadammyers.com for all tickets. Email the podcast at 500podcast@gmail.com. Follow the Facebook group run by Evan, who's crazy. And for all things 500, go to the website that I can't stand, the 500podcast.com. Well, not left to say, but here we go with number 324 out of 500. Station, but David Bowie. This is Gavin Rossdale on my podcast. We're talking David Bowie. And I hope I don't say something stupid to make me look dumb. Tell the rest of the band, Bush, I fucking love them. Gavin Rossdale and Josh are the newest best friends in the whole damn world. Do you love me, Mr. Gavin? Do you love me? Because I'm trying to impress you. How's that?
You're a very attractive man, but it's not love yet, but I do like you.
Dude, can I ask you a question? What is it like being, honest to God, one of the most beautiful men in the fucking world? For definitely out of the grunge scene. Definitely 100% out of the grunge scene. I put you up against anybody. What is that like?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be in Adelaide. I'm thrilled to be in Adelaide.
First thing is this, because I want to get to the Easter eggs that I've found in some of your music that is influenced by Bowie. Did you grow up in a musical household? Like, what was your musical childhood experience like?
Well, you know, like my parents, when they were together, they broke up when I was 12. I lived with my dad after that, but there was a typical kind of small house, regular people. She had like, my mom had like Roberta Flack, one record of hers, Queen, and Carole King, Tapestry. You know, nice. It wasn't that many records. It wasn't a big thing, but what was incredible was that two things. One, I lived my house, the closest shop to my house up the street was a record store.
Nice.
So it's very much like that Malcolm Gladwell, that 10,000 hours thing. But the Malcolm Gladwell thing, like you surround yourself, you know, it's only that proximity to music that kind of allowed me to spend all my pocket money on records.
Yeah.
And my aunt lived with us when I was young, and she was amazing fun, out all night, coming in, you know, she had just was like a real wild spirit. She lived at our house because she was too wild to have a regular life. And she gave me the man who fell, the Bowie, the Ziggy Stardust.
Okay.
Life and Times of Ziggy Stardust. And that changed my life because where I grew up was kind of pretty rough. And everyone was into like, you know, they would wear like, I don't know if you know what Pharaoh slacks are, Gabici tops. They were like poor people trying to, they would dress rich.
Yeah. I still wear that.
Rich, Pharaoh, right? Football hooligans, you know, like,
yeah.
Asbos, antisocial behavior order kids, right? So everyone loved, it's so weird I'm doing this thing, this podcast, because for instance, a big song then was Patrice Rushen when we were growing up. She had the song Send Me Forget Me Nots. It used to be this like disco song.
I know that.
And I was on a phone call the other day because I was using his phone doing press, and Patrice Rushen sent him a text. He's a tour manager for a bunch of people.
Yeah.
Patrice Rushen sent him a text. I was like, oh my God, Patrice Rushen. I knew her when I was like 8 years old. She's so cool, you know.
Yeah.
Send me, forget me. Anyway, and but I didn't really like that music so much. I would like, so I've always been like a bit of an art jock because I grew up playing football and, you know, hanging out on the streets with all my friends and all that kind of nonsense that you do sitting around the States and stuff. And but I would always like, had my secret Bowie world because I thought that obviously that was not, you know, it was a bit more taboo, and they didn't really want sort of any feminine-esque outlandish figures. You know, anyone like, you know, if I said the word amazing, I'd get slapped around the head.
Wow.
You know, for being too fancy. Yeah, you just get to be like really like play it dumb, low-key.
Yeah.
And just, so I've always, and when we used to go to all the dances and all that, you know, I loved all the goth girls, the punk girls. I was a young punk, you know. I was into punk music and, but just loved all playing football and playing tennis. So I've always been an art jock. I'm into that. I'm into painting, food, yeah. Art, music, and I love sport. You know, I like it both.
So you're
in. So that was a big, Bowie was the stepping stone into everything, because you know I could afford singles each week, and I have all those punk classics. I have all the punk records, all the Sex Pistols, Clash, Revillos, X-Ray Specs, Buzzcocks, Jam, everyone yeah. like that. I used to love that, all those records. But up the road where I go in there, they would be trying to school me and be like, check out the Doors. This is so-and-so, this is Bread, this is fucking Carole King, this is the Beach Boys, this is whoever. Yeah. So it was really, you know, like a free education from strangers who ran the record store. And I'm always grateful for that. And it's weird because I didn't really make music. You know, I didn't think I would ever be able to make music. I just sort of loved it. And then when I left school, I was like, fuck, which way's the job? That way, what else is there? What else can I do? What else can I do? I can't. I just began to write songs. And I was talking last night with my guitar player about it over dinner. Chris, I was saying like it's so mental because I had no ability, no knowledge, no training, no nothing. Just sort of would do anything to avoid a standard regular job. I didn't go to college, you know. I just, what could I do? And I remember being so arrogant with my dad and be like recording into a tape. We'd be like tape recorders then.
Yeah.
It's like sing a song. Like it must have been like maybe on two notes, some terrible piece of drivel. And then I had a couple of guys who I knew from a school be like, you know, put some chords to that. And we sort of had this, my first band. And it was such like youthful arrogance because I just forced my way into it. And, you know, that's why with me it's a weird journey because I'm sort of always getting better and always learning because I didn't really come at it like you know, virtuoso kid trained, sit in my room for like 10 years
yeah.
until I was unleashed on the world. I sort of just kind of grew up trying to get it done, you know, in front of A&R men and in front of people. And it's an interesting story, but it's a very flying by the seat of your pants kind of life. You know, it's not, I wouldn't recommend it to any of my kids, and I've got loads of kids. I'd be like, do not do it like that. That's the worst idea.
So once you got that bug inside you that you were like, dude, I don't want a regular job. I don't want it. Cause that was me and my dad, the exact same thing. Like every day my dad would read the paper in the morning, have his breakfast. And then he put the paper down and do this sigh of just like knowing that he had to go out into the world to do this job that he didn't want to do, but had to support the family. When you watch that, much like you being like, I don't want to have a regular factory job. Like I want to fucking do something. And for me, it was comedy and music. And obviously for you, it was music and the arts and so on. So would you say that moment really after the record store is kind of schooling you and now you've been introduced to Ziggy Stardust, like that's the turning point where it's like, this is something I want to do. This is something I have to do.
Oh, no. It wasn't for a few years yet.
Okay.
It was like 3 or 4 years. Because all I did is I got lost in it. All it was a refuge. And so when people, and I, you know, I'm lucky and I see people wherever I go. I was in a bar yesterday. I always walk around, check out the neighborhood. And I love to go walk and check where I'm at. You know?
Yeah.
So I end up in this bar. It's like one barman and like some loser the other end of the bar, you know. And me, yeah. three losers in a bar at like 1 p.m. on a hot day. I mean, a cold asahi. And I was just intrigued, you know, about the guy. He started talking about Axl Rose or some bullshit. So I was thinking, I like to test people, you know, if they knew about that. I want to test the promo. How many people is this reaching? You know what I mean? That we're on. So it's like, hey, what have you heard about Under the Southern Stars? He goes, not too much about that, mate. Yeah. I said, cool, because I heard it's on 3 days here. He goes, oh, yeah, I heard something about a festival like that. I said, yeah, I heard of some great bands. You know, I was fucking with him. You know what I mean? And he goes, I haven't heard too much about it. I heard a bit about it, but I don't know. Yeah, not Guns N' Roses, is it? I was like, nah, that's some other, but it's STP. He goes, what are you doing here? You're going to see the festival? I said, I'm working at it. He goes, oh, cool. What's your band? You know, and I was like, oh, I'm in this band. I'm in the band Bush. And so the guy at the end of the bar goes, pipes up, he goes, I remember them. Like I said, this cunt the one. So, maybe it was a bit of a laugh, but it's been fun to be back on tour because I like all those interactions with strangers and with people.
Yeah,
they don't normally get.
No, oh my god, that's like, talking to people after show is some of the most entertaining shit in the world.
You know, with music, it's like this refuge for people, right? And mm-hmm. people get lost in it, and that's what I did for the first few years. In a way, it's even almost better way around. Well, no, I don't know. There was no other way around. But I got lost to music for a lot longer before I was ready to think I could even make it. I didn't dissect it. I dissected it later. And when I began playing guitar, I would learn all those Bowie songs because they're really good for busking. You know, especially the Ziggy Stardust, they work well on those lovely chords and stuff like that. And so, but no, I got lost in music and then I began to make it later on. And then it became my life work.
Yeah.
My life's work.
Hey, you. Do you have any plans this year? How's that going? Did you get 2020? Well, welcome to a brand new podcast called 2020, where myself, Benny Goodman, and my good friends, Corey Pazin and Siobhan Cronin from the band Lost Symphony also got 2020.
And since the world ended this year, we decided why not just check in with some of our friends in the music industry and see how everyone's doing.
We're going to get a candid look at life on and off the stage, as well as the mindset of some of the most successful people in the entertainment industry.
New episodes drop every Sunday and Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern.
And you can listen at 2020-D.com, soundtalentmedia.com, or on your favorite podcast app.
This is Krista Makes, guitarist and vocalist for Less Than Jake, and host of Krista Makes a Podcast, a songwriting podcast where every week I'm joined by an amazing guest to break down the writing, recording, and release of one iconic song from their career. In our giant evergreen back catalog of episodes, we've had rock legends such as Dee Snider and Huey Lewis, punk rock favorites like Mark Hoppus, Fat Mike, and Brett Gurewitz, and up-and-coming artists of today, such as Liz Stokes of The Beths and Genesis Owusu. We've had guests from all genres and styles of music, and I guarantee that if you peruse our back catalog, you'll see several episodes that'll make you say, man, I gotta hear that. Whether you're a fan of music or a creator of music yourself, you'll take away a whole new appreciation for the songs you know and love. Krista Makes a Podcast is available for free on all the places you could possibly listen to podcasts. And new episodes come out every Monday.
So for Bowie, like, I mean, I'm going through, like, you know, 16 Stone. I mean, obviously, in everything Zen, you take a Bowie lyric. How influential was Bowie, and has he been on your career?
Well, I mean, it's funny that because that came out, you know, when I was doing Bush in London, it was like the worst commercial idea you could ever have. That was the height of Britpop. Everything was going on with Blur, Oasis, yeah. Suede, all those kind of bands, Pulp. And we were just like, we were just trying to be the Pixies. I mean, I was trying to be the Pixies. Just thought they were the most exciting band. I loved that whole 4AD label. I liked throwing music, the Cocteau Twins, but the Pixies, they had the most beautiful cover, had the flamenco girl on there, it's a gold record, gold cover. And I just couldn't believe this band was just so, they were doing rock music that wasn't Poison, wasn't like hair rock.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it went from, I like Sex Pistols, Public Image, the you know, those are the bands I really liked, Talking Heads, you know, and it's a sort of like anti-establishment, but not sort of glam rock, you know, which some people like. I mean, fuck me, Motley Crue, who are the kings of that, and I love Tommy Lee, and he's a friend of mine. I mean, they're now playing stadiums, you know, people love all that stuff, you know, people love that. But I liked the fact that the Pixies were more concerned with hummus.
Yeah.
And good songs. The singer from Suede, Brett, and he interviewed him, and he was going to him. How come you're so good? So I was listening to Suede, couldn't understand the music that much, but everyone was saying the greatest band, and I was just jealous. I was just like fucking hell! I can't get a break. Can't get arrested. Now this fuck. It's like, and so when I was doing this heavier sort of this, I wasn't quite that bad, but they were my most inspiring band. And so I wrote in there about Kissy Kiss in the rear view. It was because they were sat in the interview in this cab, with Bo was telling him how great he was, and I was just jealous, which is a terrible emotion. I'm not even a jealous person, but I was just like annoyed. And I never expected anyone to hear it, because I was so used to making songs that didn't get past the demo stage. Like, I could get demos from any label in London, in England, you know, EMI, CBA, Epic. I just couldn't get signed. And so much like the Pixies signed in England with 4AD, being from Boston, we signed with a small label in the Valley. I did it the other way around. So I based my career, not my career, but it was like I was empowered by their journey. And I was thinking, well, if it worked for them, why can't the reverse be true for us?
Yeah.
And so everyone told me not to do the deal. It's brilliant. The main person who told me was a friend of mine who succumbed to an overdose. And the last thing he told me, well, I said, for God's sake, don't sign a deal to America. Oh, he was fucking wrong, wasn't he? He was completely wrong. Best thing I ever did. And plus, I had no alternatives. And nothing beats a choice than having nothing else, no options.
Yes.
You know, that's your choice, you know?
Yeah.
That's the epitome of a choice. So that's what we did. But yeah, so it's been an interesting journey of transatlantic belief, and then like this kind of, yeah, it's weird, wild journey.
Yeah. So what was that like then for, you know, you signed with this American label, you know, it's against the grain of what's popular in England at the time, because all the bands that you mentioned, I mean, Blur, I would never, it's Britpop, and you know, it's like, so what is that like to suddenly put out this record and then for it to just become a smash hit? I mean, dude, it's one of the biggest records of my high school years. It's still one of my favorites. I've re-listened to it just prepping for this, and I'm like, God damn, dude, it's fucking perfect.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, it was weird, you know, after that, I went back to work. We made the record, and then we lost the distribution deal. So I went back to work. I painted 12 dentist's offices right after that. Identical. It was like a Kafka nightmare. And big in Magnolia. Down in the West End of London. And I didn't really mind. It's because I thought I just wanted to make a record, you know. I was back making $50 a day painting. I had made a record, and I just felt like that was my voting point. No one had believed in me. And, you know, when you're young, that's what I hated about that fucking biopic, that Queen biopic. I just thought it was such nonsense. He's in the front room, Freddie, playing Bohemian Rhapsody. Like, no one's found out how amazing I am. He's playing Bohemian Rhapsody. It's like, shut up. like, play something terrible so no one discovers you. Don't play Bohemian Rhapsody like you're Rachmaninoff in waiting. Like, that was so like a made-for-TV movie. It's just annoying because it had no reality of being terrible. And most of us were just terrible for ages. And some would argue we still are, but we try our best.
Yeah. So then what was that like for the record to suddenly take off the way that it did?
It was the most beautiful thing I've ever experienced in my life. And a sort of not a vindication. It wasn't like I gave a, you know, I just, the best thing is, you know, when people don't believe in you and people put you down, and I've had a lot of that in my life, the biggest response is not an aggressive confrontation that you wish for in your head, like, you know, sort of, do you know what I mean? Perspective. The best thing I can do is just be wildly successful, is to make a wildly good song. That's the biggest fuck you to anyone. You know what I mean? Because, and I've been doing it for years, you know, we've had like 25 hits on the radio. That's a lot. That's a lot. That's a lot. I think. I mean, not to brag about, but when I think about it, I go, that's pretty funny. Makes me laugh.
Yeah.
Some people only have one hit, you know? I've written 25. It's quite a, that's right. There's lots of people with lots more than me, but I'm better than a lot of the naysayers, you know?
100%.
So it felt beautiful. It felt really good. And I was way more depressed to be unsuccessful. And I felt really like it was an effrontery to my own ego of like, God, I can't do better than this. Continually not getting the breaks, continually hitting a brick wall, doors are open. I was like, man. So when that happened, it wasn't like I became like completely flash and full of myself. I just felt like finally I don't have a barrier to get into people. I don't have a barrier. Like if I write a song, people can judge. First band had a record out and not an album. And I was signed to Epic, like 2 years into writing songs. So I had a knack for it. And they brought out two singles. And I remember like being at home, like just sitting there with my fingers crossed going, well, it's out. And if people wanted to hear it, you know, no one ever heard it and it sank without a trace. But when Bush hit, I just always knew that within reason, if we had something new, people would know about it. You know, I mean, I'm asking a lot 30 years later, but that's the reality of it. That I just felt like, well, at least now I get, you know, there's an open window to what we're doing. You know, that's what made.
Yeah. So I've re-listened to, I re-listened to 16 Stone. And as I was trying to, and as I'm listening to Station, I'm trying to see if I can find somewhat comparisons between certain songs, certain moments. Tell me if I'm wrong. Like Testosterone, were you listening to a lot of Bowie when you were writing Testosterone? It has a feel of like a Bowie song.
I mean, I the reason I like that song, I'm proud of it, is it was sort of it was a metrosexual anthem. You know what I mean? It was a metrosexual anthem. And
very.
I think the one thing that Bowie brought to us now we take it for granted because, you know, the world is so fluid. We live in such a fluid world where, I mean, I have young kids, you know, and it's incredible seeing how the lack of homophobia, the acceptance of self-expression, the fluidity of everyone, sexuality. It's like, you know, when we're growing up, you know, you couldn't, you know what I mean? It's like, you have to sort of, I don't know, you just couldn't be as free. Certainly where I grew up, I'm sure where you grew up in New York, you know, you get to be like, it was just much more homophobic.
And of course. And
to me, writing Testosterone was a dismantling of that bullshit, you know, and that's what I was really proud of because I thought it was a, you know, whenever you have a song that you figure and you write, it's good to get ideas off your chest. They're sort of just ideas you get off your chest and you kind of like, they belong to the world after that. And then to be in a successful band that's like shunning toxic masculinity in 95, you know, that's cool. You know, I'm like, that's a decent thing to do. You know, that's the right way to have a progressive society.
Yeah. What is that like though? You know, when because you were born in 1965 and obviously you said the first record was Ziggy Stardust, which I mean, I'm born in 79. You know what I mean? Like I had the hair metal, you know, Androgyny, But I mean, is David Bowie like really the first artist to kind of blend that gap between male and female? And what is that like to when you're in your teens to see somebody doing that?
Well, I think the seeing him on Top of the Pops when he was like all the extraordinary outfits, it just was like, I didn't think anything out of it apart from he just seemed like this mystical kind of theatrical figure. He's like, you know, he's like Bertolt Brecht, you know, he just combined theater with it. I didn't actually, as a kid, I was too young, too innocent to really take it on a sexuality level. Mm-hmm. It was only later when he spoke about his, you know, sexuality that was like, oh, wow, that's interesting. But I didn't even really know what that meant. You know what I mean? It's sort of like, just meant he was dangerous because, as I say, where I grew up in, I grew up in North London and was very, very homophobic. And so you grew up without not even knowing what they really meant. You know, when you're a kid, you don't really know. You don't know about sex. You don't know what they're actually talking about. You just know that guys are meant to act as sort of a brutish, thuggish, loud, obnoxious, and girls are meant to be kind of like laid back and demure and subservient. You know, that's how it was. That's the hierarchy that I grew up with. You know, that's how everyone was. And then as life does, that's been traded off. You know, the last few years, obviously, it's been incredible. Revolution for women, you know, long overdue, you know? So if we just made me think, you know, and he says, but not just about the sexuality stuff, because as I say, I was too young for that. It was more the sort of all that cut up to all those like disparate ideas. That's how he influenced me the most, because I loved Ginsberg growing up. And so lyrically, I'd always get in trouble when I first began, you know, when they wanted to kill me in reviews. If they didn't just hate me straight up, it would be like, the lyrics don't make sense. This and that is like, there's all these pieces. And I was like, I just don't get it. I just don't get it, you know, because that's what the Burroughs cut up technique, Bowie used that, there's Ginsberg, all that, City Lights store in San Francisco, where they published all the beat poets. You know, the beat poets were almost like the precursors. I mean, grunge, it's funny you said the word grunge.
Seattle Sound.
That thing of disenfranchised, it's the disenfranchised feelings. It's the sort of you know, and so I don't know, I just always related to that. You know, I grew up in an environment where I had to listen to Bowie in private, also get beaten up for like, you know, I lived in an environment where carrying a tennis racket to the bus to go play tennis racket at the local club because I fell in love with it off the TV, you'd get slapped on the way to the bus stop, you know, for like having a sort of an instrument of wealth and step below a violin with a tennis racket.
Yeah.
You know, idiot. Like, you know, 16-year-old kids, you're like 11 years old, like just getting slapped on the way to the bus because you love tennis, you know. It's kind of funny when I think about it now, but I still love it. Didn't stop me.
Who's your favorite tennis player of all time?
Bjorn Borg.
Really? You're a Bjorg fan. Okay. All right. Boris Becker, dude.
Well, just because that was when I was a kid and just watched him grow up. And in fact, he practiced at my club, played at a tennis club called the Cumberland in England. And they had grass courts. And one time I saw him warming up and I saw him in the locker room. He was the first famous person I ever met. And I just remember being, I don't know, like, I don't know what I was, how old I was. Must have been 9 or 10. And I saw him and I said to him, it was the dumbest fan moment because I remember seeing it. He's standing there, I think he's naked, he had a towel and he came out of the shower. It's Bjorn Borg and he's like crazy wide shoulders. As a kid, I was like, oh my God. I said to him, good luck. I know you're going to win it. And as I left, I've always been annoyed that I said that. Like, you know, people, it's armchair, I've got a feeling about today. It's always annoying when sports fans go, oh, I've got a feeling about this one. I feel good today. It's like, shut up. You're nothing to do with it. You know, I'm happy for you, but you're clearly nothing to do with it. Right? But so I said that to him. I did my worst thing and I always regretted it. I've regretted it ever since because, like, it just was like such a like cookie cutter thing to say to him, you know? And I wanted to tell him so much more, but people get tongue-tied. People get tongue-tied when they meet me, you know? And it's very sweet. And they, so many times, I don't want to say, I don't want to say. I was like, before Corona, you could just hug someone.
Yeah,
you
know,
now. Just have a contact. Just like, silence the moment. Now it's like, you put your arm out
about
10 feet.
Fist bump you. I'll fist bump you. I know you're obsessed with my music, yeah. And I'm the biggest artist of your lifetime, but there you go. Just touch my knuckle.
Hey, this is Chris Swinney, formerly of the Ataris and currently host of That One Time on Tour, part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. Have you ever wondered what it's really like on the road? The highs can be euphoric, but the lows can be crushing. Join me every week as I chat with industry pros about what it's like living out their wildest dream and, in some cases, their worst nightmare. Past guests of the show include members of NoFX, Pennywise, Bad Religion, and more. Listen and subscribe at SoundTalentMedia.com.
Hey, what's up? My name's Lurk, and I'm the host of Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast. Every week, I have in-depth conversations with bands from all over the scene, big and small. We also like to keep our finger on the pulse and showcase up-and-coming bands on the show as well. So come check out Lamb Goat's Van Flip Podcast.
You, if I'm not mistaken, you've—I know you've met Bowie. Did you? Are you open for him too?
Yeah, well, I toured twice with him.
Tell us
and
about
then I became,
that.
And I became. In South America, I opened for him in South America on a stadium tour two times, and then I became friends with him. You know, I mean, I don't know, I can't claim, I don't know the hierarchy of friends. I would imagine, I don't know what division I was. I was on the email division. Collaborations was spoken about, and you know, I'd go and see him if I was. Well, I remember going walking from my house in Los Feliz to go see him at the Greek when he played there. And so I hung out with him a few times. Then the last few years, just emails. And in fact, I owed him an email. I have an email from him I didn't reply to. Because again, I was getting an email from him. It was a bit of a thrill. You know, chatting about what he's up to, this and that, asking what I'd been doing. And you know, then I had this very deep connection after he passed. Well, I met Mike Garson with Bowie a few times because I would go see shows. I was on tour with Mike in South America with him, and although we were an opening band, you know, sort of would say hello respectfully and whatever. But after he passed, they had this whole thing where a bunch of singers went and played with the original bands. He had a whole entourage group of all the musicians over the years with Bowie, and I played I'm Afraid of Americans with that band over two nights at the, I think, the Wilton. And then I did a song with Mike for Music Cares. I did a version of Heroes with him. It's on the new record, on the Kingdom, on this bonus track. There's a me singing Heroes with Mike Garson playing piano. And then Mike played on this song I have called Undone. And he played the piano on that. And we've become really, really, really close, I would say. Close friends.
Nice.
And I'm really grateful for that. I love Mike. And so yeah, my Bowie connection is deep. And you know, I knew Iman. I feel like I haven't spoken to her in a long time. You know, in the divorce fire, I haven't spoken to her. But yeah, Bowie was amazing. You know, and just so funny and so well read and like just laugh. You know, and just a as you'd imagine.
I could imagine. I mean, everything I know about him is he's like the king of cool. And I mean, my first, yeah. I guess, real like taking in a Bowie, I mean, as a kid was Labyrinth, and he was just bigger than life with the hair and the Muppets. And then it's like, you know, and I'll be honest. I'll say this to you. I'll say this to Adam. I'll say this to all the listeners. For until this record, which we're about to talk about, Station to Station, I was a strictly hits Bowie. Ziggy Stardust, I had dug into and I had listened to many times, which I loved that record. But when it came to actually listening to a full Bowie record, it just, I'm not going to say it just never made its way in there. I just never took the time to do it. So Station to Station, having this come up on the list, was the first time I was like, all right, you know, I'm going to sit and listen to this record from start to finish by David Bowie. I don't know anything about it yet. And I remember when it starts, and I don't know if you've listened to it, Gavin, on headphones, and it probably is the same way on speakers as well. It's just like it fucks with you by going back and forth. There's all those noises as it drops into the first song. And I remember I had this moment, which was like, am I about to become a David Bowie fanatic? Is this the moment that changes my life forever? And over the last... You know, I think I've been really digging on this for about 2-3 weeks since we knew this was coming up. And I mean, I've just gone through almost every record, I've listened to a lot of shit all the way through. This is an interesting album. So I'd love, because I know your favorite Bowie song, if I have it correctly, is The Man Who Sold the World. Am I right?
I mean, I don't, to be honest, I don't have any favorites. I mean, it's funny because working with Mike, when he asked me to sing recently and I wasn't able to do it, I was not well. But it's so fun because he's like, you know, pick a song. You know, when you pick a song, you know, pick one of his songs. Ironically, when I was going to do the song with him for Music Cares, I said to him, which is on this record, of course, Wild as the Wind, it ends with Wild as the Wind, Nina Simone's, right? And I said, have you ever done Wild as the Wind, like super mellow? When I take people's songs, like I did Mind Games for John Lennon for this tribute record for John Lennon, I like taking classic songs and slowing them down to my sort of funereal,
yeah,
depressing. I just love that. And singing a classic song slowly, there's nothing like it. I mean, Cat Power has built an entire career off that.
For sure. Dude, but Mind Games, which is arguably one of my favorite John Lennon songs. If you take that down, I would love to hear that. That's a brilliant song. I would love to hear it at a different tempo. That's fucking powerful.
You should. On Spotify, I think it's out there.
No, I'll check it out.
It's pretty. I was on radio in Australia 2 days ago, Triple J, and the guy goes, I've been checking this jam, and he just played 2 minutes of Mind Games on the radio. It's really pretty. Anyhow, so I was going to do Wild as the Wind, and then he sent me, because this is the Nina Simone version that David really liked. This is the version that David did live in New York. I was like, whoa, back up, big guy. I think it's been done. What else? Have you ever done the Heroes slowly? I was not going to touch it after Nina Simone and Bowie. I says, no, I never. What am I doing? Now I'm back to bullshit kid. Say, I can do that. Yeah. Bring it. I think what's so brave about this record, not only the beginning, and it's his first of the Berlin trilogy, right, with Iggy Pop. And so it just was so short and different, and it was the beginning of this sort of new period for him. I mean, I find it difficult sometimes to keep up with artists who have lots of records. This is his 10th record, so I wasn't old enough at any point, still not old enough, to know there's 9 records. Like, I wasn't a feverish fanatic, but I loved him through and through. So, you know, I think it's just it was the beginning of a whole new era, and it was that sort of funky kraut rock thing going on, and then goes on into what is it? Was Low next? Maybe, yeah. Low was the next 2 records.
Yeah,
I don't know. I'm not a Bowie expert. I just know what I like. But yeah, it's a beautiful record, you know.
So what sticks out from this record to you? Like, what are the things that you take away from this?
Well, The Wild as the Wind was beautiful. I had it was really annoying, actually, because I had this girl that I was seeing at the time, Sarah Laurie, and I got her Madness song. It was cute because Madness was really big where I was living in, really big, and we were kids, and I got her the single Must Be Love. I got it from up the road, and she gave me Wild as the Wind, but she totally out sophisticated me like 1,000 times. Yeah. I was like, God, I should have said this. So I just love that song, and just, I'd never heard anything like. And Bowie did it over and over for me personally, where he just opened you up to different possibilities. I mean, like to hear Wild as the Wind, nothing come before that I could put my finger on to be so vulnerable. And, you know, there was such a, as I was saying before, there's such sort of a simple black and white line of like masculine, you know, guys weren't soft. Guys were hard, girls were soft. That was it. And so for having a song like Wild as the Wind, it just was like a sensitivity. I remember being thinking to myself, is he allowed to be that vulnerable? Is he allowed to be that open, you know? Or people are, he's not going to get slapped. He's not going to get slapped for that, you know?
Yeah.
But I love it. It's beautiful. When I think about it, there's songs that I've written that's been in the DNA of those songs. Lots of mellow songs I've written. There's one song, Surrender, I don't know, from that approach to music and that sort of, that vulnerability, you know?
Yeah.
Vulnerability.
Well, I mean, I think you can hear your vulnerability in a song like Glycerin. you know? I mean, dude, do you understand how many dudes were able to like hook up with their girlfriend because they learned that on guitar? You're looking at me, dude. I fucking, those simple chords, you wrote beautiful lyrics. I mean, dude, it's fucking brilliant. So I could definitely see some of the influences from this record, even in some of your music. I wanted to ask you, because this is the main thing that I got. You already mentioned the Berlin stuff that he was doing. So, and you probably do know about this, but for all the listeners out there, during the sessions for Station to Station, Bowie was heavily dependent on drugs, especially cocaine, and recalls almost nothing of the production. He once joked, I know it was recorded in LA because I read it was. He also added, I have serious problems about that year or two. I can't remember how I felt. I have no emotional geography. And because of that addiction, it severed relationships with some of his fellow musician friends like Keith Moon, John Lennon, and Harry Nilsson. So this is a cocaine record.
It was just weird. I think Oasis made the cocaine.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? The one with, you know, look out to pay with a gentleman.
Those records from the 90s from Oasis, there's stuff. Well, he was famous. I mean, Noel was famous for always saying, never went like 40 minutes, he never went without having a line of coke. But I think it can sound a bit thin because you're so jacked, you keep wanting, it's not bright enough, it's too dark, you know. And it doesn't sound, I mean, I guess that Harry Meslin, I guess you could say Bowie wasn't sharing his coke with that guy.
Not everybody can
I
be
don't
fucked
get
up.
Cocaine. It's like cocaine, I've heard, is like, you know, you solve the world's problems, you sit with your friends all night, you talk a bunch of shit, and then you feel terrible the next day. And that's about it. You have a laugh. But as far as this doesn't seem like a creative drug, Bowie managed to make it creative and make magic out of it. But it's ironic, isn't it? He didn't have any time to be done.
Yeah. No, I listen, you could, most people do cocaine and, you know, get nothing accomplished. He made a fucking brilliant record. And I feel like after me listening to it and finding out about the coke, I kind of think the reason Station to Station is over 10 minutes long, you know, I think 100% the different movements, almost maybe he couldn't decide on one, you know, chord progression. And then he was like, oh, this would be good to change it here. And then, oh, because that's like, you're, you know, when you're doing coke and you're listening to music, you're like, all right, let's put on this song. So definitely Station to Station gives me coke vibes. I was with this girl the other night and I told her that we're about to do this record together. And she's like, this is my favorite record. She was the one that explained to me before I'd read anything that this was the coke record. She said this album completely is like doing cocaine, the way it starts, then how it goes into the golden years, because the golden years is everything's like, oh, everything's going to be great, man. This is the best ever. We're having the best time. It can't get better than this. And then he brings it down with Word on a Wing. And then you've got the beginning of side two with TVC 1-5 and Stay. And it's just, and then even in like in Stay, he's talking about lyrically struggling with the monotony of drug addiction. And then into, you know, Wild as the Wind, which is a fucking beautiful song. So I think I don't, you know 100% if he didn't do cocaine, that if this record would have turned out. But I definitely think that it's like, I think it's pretty, you know, it's pretty spot on to be that big in your career. You doing coke and it's just, you know, no, you have the studio, do whatever the fuck you want to do. So,
I mean, the musicians are incredible.
100%.
Carlos Alomar and the band. And I don't think the band, I mean, the band held their shit together no matter what, you know.
No, they were dialed in.
It wasn't him alone in the studio, you know what I mean?
No, they were there. No, the band completely dialed in. What do you think about the character that he created, the thin white man? Like, what do you...
You know, another one of his characters. I love Ziggy Stardust, and I my best friend in London is a Bowie freak. So he probably knows, he knows a lot more than I do about Bowie, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, it just was a new character and like super stylish and a different look and a bit more that kind of I don't know, Anthony Price suits and all the kind of look. And so, I mean, it just was a new character. It's, I like the sound of it, thin white Duke.
Yeah, yeah. So this is one of our Patreon questions from Justin Nemec. So like we said, this is the debut of Thin White Duke. What is your favorite of his many personalities or eras? So we got the folk singer, Ziggy Stardust, Aladdin Sane, the Plastic Soul, Young Americans era, collaborating with Trent Reznor. Which one is your favorite?
I mean, Ziggy Stardust was something extraordinary to me. And, you know, it has such memories for me because it was when I first found out about him. And it was really precious because I loved my aunt so much that for her to give me that cultural kind of weapon was just amazing. And so my love for him is in tandem with my love for her. So it's very deep for me.
I don't think it overstates things to say that the Beatles were the greatest gift to entertainment and culture of our time, a secular religion, if you will, with their universal appeal and demonstrable impact on people's lives. I'm Robert Rodriguez, host of Something About the Beatles. With every episode, I speak with historians, musicians, artists, and Beatle witnesses, all in the service of fresh insights into the most joyous cultural entity the world has ever known. I hope you'll join me and listen to Something About the Beatles, now on Evergreen and wherever you get your podcasts.
So I liked everything he did, really. There's nothing, I even, you know, maybe Labyrinth was my, not my favorite bit, one you got into, but movie industry is so out there, so weird. But I really loved that. I loved that Earthing record. I thought that drum and bass record was phenomenal. It was so brilliant. But basically, stuff that he did, you know, he just had a way about him. And that last, you know, it's ending on the Black Star, that last record released on the Friday, Birthday on the Weekend, Died on the Monday. It's just like that Black Star song is just unbelievable. It was really funny, actually. Because when I did the show for the Bowie event with his band, I chose Young I'm Afraid of Americans. They gave me a range of stuff to choose from. I chose I'm Afraid of Americans, right? And it was really good because the band was fucking great. There were so many versions of it. I had to be super type A and I felt really awkward about it, but I wrote the arrangement out and gave it to each band member because I didn't want to fuck up on the night. I was like in the rehearsal, it was going, everyone's playing different versions. Oh, this is from Stockholm from 1979. This is not the version. No. And so I wrote the arrangement out. So we got it down, we dialed it, and I didn't mean to be drilling them, but they needed someone to be like, no, this is the arrangement. And I gave it to everyone. And we had an amazing time. I was so nervous. It was really brilliant. But the best part was poor old Sting, who I love and admire. But this was brilliant because he played Black Star with his lute, right? Now, Bowie doing Black Star, it's just, 13-minute song. Bowie doing Black Star, we're all going to be there like, but Sting with a lute, you know, he's asking for it, isn't he? He's going out there in a sweater and playing the lute or some shit. So the first night, I was so nervous I couldn't even speak, and I rushed left afterwards. I was like, why did I leave? It was like a balloon with a air out of it, you know, like flying off out of the room. I was just traumatized by the whole event. I was like, why am I home? I want to be seeing anyone else. So next, and I performed again, when I saw Sting, I said, how'd it go last night? He goes, oh, you know, the critics. I was thinking, well, you did come in with a fucking lute, cruising for a bruising. But hey, Sting's amazing. He gets a hard time, but I think he's great.
No, I love Sting. All right, let's see if we have any more Patreon questions. So Station to Station is produced at a really dark time in Bowie's life. The darkest, according to him, and he admitted to the drugs and years later said he, like I said before, he didn't even recall recording the record. What does that say about Bowie that he was still able to produce such an acclaimed album under those conditions?
Well, they say the same thing happened to Elton, right? Elton John, he had a whole bunch of like records in the 80s that he can't remember either. It just means that he was surrounded by great people because he didn't make the record on his own. And he didn't press record, and he wasn't playing guitar or bass or drums or mixing it. So it's a bit incorrect to think that because he was out of it, so was everyone else. It wasn't like if they'd all been on coke, that would have been really funny.
Yeah.
Then I think they would have been in the record. Do you know what I mean? But I think there was clearly some people that were had their shit together because it's not easy to record that stuff and mix it great and whatever they did. So we see that Bowie was incredibly collaborative because he lent on. When you got Carlos Alomar being a guitar player, you can fuck off and do cocaine. You'll be on the track, going to be fine.
Yeah.
So there's all these people like, oh my God, Bowie wasn't even there. How did it even happen? It's like magic. Not really. It's called other people.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
I'm bursting someone's bubble. Patrick.
No, not at all. All right. We ask these questions to all of the guests. So thank you so much for coming on, buddy. I appreciate it. Favorite song on the record?
Wild as the Wind.
Okay. Mine, I want to say Station to Station. I really do. I love the four parts. Least favorite song on the record?
I'm looking at the title. I'm looking at things. I don't know. My least favorite. I mean, it's got a few. It's got definitely got a few album tracks on there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I don't. But I like album tracks. I mean, it sounds weird. It's not. I don't have a least. Nothing annoys me on it.
I get it.
I love the record. You know, I like, but nothing. Not, you know, TBC 15, it's all right. A little repetitive, but it's all right. I got the idea. How many TBC 15 have you got? A lot.
I actually picked, you're going to hate me. I actually picked Wild as the Wind. If I had to pick one, I don't know if you should end the record on that. I'm not saying it's a bad song.
It's like, what's this about Iggy Pop's girlfriend? I think it's an alien. So I'm looking at it now. Yeah, but it's just such a... I mean, and that's what's beautiful about music, you know?
Yeah.
I think that... You know, having a Nina Simone song, it's just brilliant, you know? Subversive. At that time, imagine at that time. I mean, that's like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's groundbreaking. And at least he was not appropriating the culture. He was actually just like paying homage to it.
Yeah.
By using someone as brilliant. I mean, Nina Simone was fierce. Fierce. Is a fierce, amazing, terrifying person. Have you seen that documentary on her? She's like, she's all power.
Love her. All right, what song on this record would you fuck to?
Well, you know, it's a 36 minute record, so let's hope most of it.
Okay, you start right from the jump. Okay, I dig that. I could do 36. I could definitely.
No guarantee. But you know.
Older we get, man, the time gets less and less.
Yeah, yeah. This undressing, this getting dressed. Is that
you could throw that in there? Sure, I'll let you have that. And then the last question: do you think, out of all of Bowie's records, and wait, what other albums, Adam, are on the 500 greatest albums list?
Okay, so the other Bowie albums that are on this list, he'll come up four more times. A Loud and Sane came in at number 279. Low was ranked at 251. Hunky Dory at 108. And The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and The Spider from Mars at number 35.
Do you, so this means this is our first David Bowie record on the list. It's the lowest ranked out of all of them. Do you think out of those other four that got mentioned, this is ranked accordingly between those? I know Ziggy Stardust is your jam, so that's the lowest and also probably the most, his biggest and most important. But do you think that this one is in the right ranking in those, in the Rolling Stone list?
Fuck Rolling Stone, who knows?
Thank you.
What do they know?
100%. 100%. Proud sponsor of the 500 Rolling Stone. Now, this was great, man. I can't thank you enough for coming on, brother. Once again, do you have anything you want to just promote away again? Anything you want us to check out, or it's your time? Go ahead.
I mean, Spotify or whatever platform you use, make it easy to check out whatever we've been doing, and we have a new record. I think, apropos of this whole conversation, Mike Garson songs I did and playing with him on the Bonus of the Kingdom should be checked out. If anyone cares about, you know, would care to hear me stealing time with Mike Garson. And it's fun for me because of all that piano stuff, the film to play on it. Just made me weep when I heard what he'd done. It made me weep.
I love it. We'll make sure we check that out, dude. Thank you so much for coming on, brother.
All right. Thank you so much. All the best.
What I tell you, the one and only Gavin Rosdale. Follow him on all social media at Gavin Rosdale and go to his website, bushofficial.com, because they are on tour right now. And I'm going, you're going, we're going. Listener shout out, MP Brown 86. Some said it couldn't be done, but he caught up on all the episodes from the beginning. MP Brown 86. That's the message he sent me. Some said I couldn't. It couldn't be done. It couldn't be done. All right, we just listened to David Bowie from 1976. Who do we got? Declan McKenna. You're listening to the song You Better Believe. And you can find links to the website, the500podcast.com. And if you want your song played, because that's what we're trying to do, send us your song to 500podcast@gmail.com. Next week is Police Week. We're doing Ghost in the Machine. Top heavy record, guys. This is going to be... Yeah, I don't know how much I'm digging on this one, guys. But, you know. And I love the Police, but... The jazz shit. Morty was still here, he'd be mad at me. All right, do your homework. Sorry, my dear. Asteroid.
What's up, everybody? I am Finn McKenty, host of the Punk Rock NBA podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. My podcast is all about doing what you love for a living, and every week I sit down and talk to people who have done exactly that. For example, musicians like Tommy from Between the Buried and Me, Matt from Periphery, Lil Lotus and Shinigami, among many others, photographers, artists, designers, YouTubers like Glenn Fricker and Sarah Dici, and I unpack exactly how they got to where they are today with the goal of helping you do the same. So if that sounds cool, you can listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com, and I'll see you there.
One Hit Thunder is a podcast where we both celebrate and have a good laugh about bands and artists that had just one hit that we all know. Each week, we're joined by a guest from the world of music or comedy to learn more than you ever thought you would about some songs that you can't forget, and we decide if they brought the One Hit Thunder or were nothing more than a one hit blunder. Look, if you listen to the show, you're probably going to laugh, and I guarantee you're going to crush next time the bar has music trivia. Tag Team, Jane Child, Meredith Brooks, Looking Glass, Sean Mullins, Eiffel 65, EMF, Crash Test Dummies, Crazy Town, Chumbawamba. We have hundreds of episodes in our back catalog and a new episode each week, so pass the Dutchie, make sure you're connected, and subscribe to One Hit Thunder wherever you get your pods.
Next Chapter Podcasts.